Since iTunes only keeps the last 100 episodes of any show, some of our show topics that seem to help the most people are no longer available when people search on iTunes. So, in an effort to make that information available to more people, from time to time we're going to re-air some of our most popular show topics. You can also go to kickitnaturally.com and search for any topic in our search box. For now, enjoy this show that originally aired in 2014.
T.C. Hill is not a doctor and does not claim to be a doctor or licensed in any type of medical field. Don't be an idiot and use anything heard on the show as medical advice. This information should be used for educational purposes only, and you should contact your doctor for any medical advice. Now get off me. Welcome to Kick It Naturally. I'm Kenna McEnroe, and I'm here with T.C. Hale, author, natural health expert, producer.
And excited person.
Excited person. Very excited today. And we also have here, to my left, little hottie patati, Will Schmidt.
Hi.
Another excited person.
Also
another
excited super person. Excited.
And Will's got some cute new glasses he's been wearing.
Oh,
I like them.
They're not, my eyes are good. They're just for style.
Oh, well, they look cute. They look really cute.
Thanks.
So we're really excited today. We have a special guest. But first, if you haven't joined us on Facebook, you're not going to know when we're having all these fabulous people on and our podcast. So you need to go to Kick It in the Nuts on Facebook. That's where we post all of our show topics. And you guys can post any questions you want us to cover on that show, and we'll try to do our best.
Yeah.
And if you have any suggestions on new shows, because, you know, we're running out.
Mm-hmm. I think we're doing plumbing next week.
Yeah. Mm. We didn't do varicose veins and spider veins.
Okay, there's another one.
Come on. I want that one.
That's on the list.
Today's guest is Dr. Gerald Pollack, and he is amazing, and it's going to be about water and some other cool stuff. He's pretty smart.
Fantastic.
He's brilliant. We're real dumb.
Can we rant about him yet, or are we still going through commercials?
I think you can rant a little bit.
Rant a little, you know. Sponsor won't care.
All right, well, I think possibly, not to discount other guests, but I'm exuberantly excited about having this guest on our show. And he is presently one of the world leaders, I think, in just the natural sciences, and the implications of his work are just incredible for the health sciences.
Yeah, it's just one of those guys that we've been studying, and we've talked about his books on shows before for a really long time, since we started doing this. And it just seems like a kind of guy wait a minute, he's going to be on our show? Why? Yeah, why is he going to do that?
It was mind-blowing how quickly he responded, and how nice of a person he is matches how intelligent of a person he is. And in the show, I would love to have him on about 19 more times. Because I feel like we barely scratched the surface of what he's all about. But you can check out his books, which we've mentioned before, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. Also, his newer book, The Fourth Phase of Water, and keep an eye out for a couple other books he's got coming up, which have other fantastic applications, more specifically towards health sciences as well as biophysics.
Cool. If you'd like to learn how to become a health coach, or even just dig into more advanced teachings for yourself or your family, go to healthprocourse.com to learn about Tony and Will's Tony and Will's course for coaches. Registration for this course only opens to the public for about a week at a time, so be sure to register for the coach newsletter so you'll be notified when the next registration opens. You'll find more info at healthprocourse.com.
Okay, let's tell the listeners about Dr. Pollack a little bit and what he's all about.
All right. Dr. Gerald Pollack is a professor of bioengineering at University of Washington. He's the author of The Fourth Phase of Water, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, and Muscles and Molecules.
Yeah, and he knows some stuff. Let's do this.
Very, very smart.
Yeah, we're here with Dr. Gerald Pollack. And Dr. Pollack, we really appreciate you coming on the show. We're a little bit geeky, psyched up, excited, like you're a rock star kind of thing to have you on the show here.
Woo-hoo.
Well, thanks for the nice introduction. Rockstar, I doubt it.
Water star?
Yeah.
It was either John Bon Jovi or you, and we chose you.
So it's just kind of fun because, and we're going to talk a little bit about what Dr. Pollack does and then where he got started. But Will and I are just very excited because your book, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, is a book that we have been promoting to people for years, and to actually have you on the show, it's almost like having Fonzie on the show.
It's pretty awesome.
It's almost like Elvis is here in the building. And my favorite part, Dr. Pollack, is when I emailed you today and you replied and you signed it Jerry. And I'm like, I'm supposed to call Dr. Gerald Pollack Jerry?
Okay.
This is unbelievable.
He's like, no, still call me doctor.
You know, here, I have a lot of undergraduates in my laboratory. And I encourage this kind of informal communication because, you know, it's just the formality tends to block good communication. There's no reason for it. And so I don't like to hide behind a professorial title. I like communication. So anyway, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, and
it's fine. Yeah.
We're such one reason that we're such big fans, and I'm really excited to talk about one of your favorite topics today, which is water. And we're going to talk about that topic in a different way than we've ever talked about it on the show, for sure. Very excited. But one of my favorite things about you is that we do this a lot, not in the brilliant manner that you do, but we say, hey, what if what everybody thinks isn't quite right? What if it's something else totally different? And I just love the way that you present information. Like, look, guys, I think we're kind of wrong about some stuff, and maybe we need to look at this in case this is what's really going on.
Yeah, well, you know, the objective, what we're all in academia and outside trying to do is to find truth. And so what we tend to do is to look into areas in science where something seems to be wrong. It doesn't add up to what you expect, and there's a problem. And that's the area that we like to investigate, because that's the most fertile ground. That's where we're going to find something that's interesting. So we tend to penetrate into those areas, and water is one of those areas. You know, water, everybody knows water, and
right, they view it like, hey, it's just water. And you know, in science, before, when you look at most you know, science textbooks or whatever, they kind of view water like it's just a carrier of all the more important stuff, all the other molecules that really count. Water is just the kind of thing that lets it all mix together a little bit. And it seems like there is now a more sophisticated view of water that's coming to light, and it kind of seems like you're the captain of that view. So,
we're definitely pursuing it. It's true. If you open any textbook that, for example, medical students look at, and physiologists and biochemists, the word water, and cell biologists, the word water is hard to find. Even, you know, you flip to the index and you look and you'll find, oh yeah, water, and there are two or three entries, and it's almost amazing because 100 years ago, all scientists knew that water was central to everything that biology does. Water is right at the center. But gradually, you know, biology became more sophisticated, quote unquote. It means that besides looking at the whole organism, you could break it down to cells, and then break it down to molecules, and break each molecule down to little parts of molecules. And then you forget about the water, because the water is just the stuff that's not included in what you're looking at. So gradually, you might say water fell out of favor, and people don't pay much attention to it. And
even though it's everywhere, even though you can't go any, you know, touch anything without water being involved in that.
It's everywhere. It's there. It's even, you know, when you breathe, you're breathing in water vapor, a lot of water vapor. And when you breathe out, you breathe out water vapor. And when you eat, so most of what you eat is water. Even if you don't drink a glass of water, if you have some vegetables, it's just like us. It's two-thirds water. And by the way, one interesting observation or fact is that, you know, most people know that by volume, we're two-thirds water. But if you count by the number of molecules, or the fraction of molecules, you know, if you do the count 1, 2, 3, 4, every 99 out of 100 of every molecules are water molecules, because in order to fill that two-thirds volume, the water molecule is pretty small. So you have to throw in a lot of those water molecules to make up the two-thirds. And so what's uncanny is the belief system that exists among many, many scientists, that 99 out of 100 of our molecules don't do anything. They're just there to bathe, as you said, the more important molecules of life.
Right, but it turns out, I guess, we're a lot more wet than we thought we were.
We are certainly a lot more wet than we thought we were. And that wetness is really important.
Okay, hold all my calls, too, in case anybody's calling for me there, Dr. Pollack.
No, it's a call for me, so I'm just letting it. Sorry, I'm
trying to.
Okay. Yeah, it's just a telemarketer, so don't worry about it.
Okay, it's fine.
So I want to get into your book, The Fourth Phase of Water. Fantastic work there, too, and a great read, and not so complicated that it hurts your brain. You really do a great job of describing things so that they make sense. But let's get into this little fourth phase of water, because everybody knows that water can be solid, liquid, and vapor, but now we got a whole new surprise. So tell us a little bit about how you came across this and explain to people what this fourth phase of water is.
Sure, happy to do so. First of all, we're not the first to suggest or identify fourth phase. This was actually predicted 100 years ago by a famous physical chemist that, you know, you can't really explain all the properties of water with three phases. So everybody knows there's a solid ice phase, a liquid water phase, and a vapor phase is the third one. And the idea was that to explain everything that you need to know about water without leaving so-called anomalies, that is, phenomena that don't fit. You know, everything has to fit if you got the right answer. And
right.
When you stuff that doesn't fit, it means, well, you know, to put it simply, you got the wrong answer or an incomplete answer.
Yeah, unless a lot of people now just say, well, that's what it is and it is what it is. Now move on to something else.
Yeah, that's right. Let it be. We just sort of, just dismiss it for the time being. Let someone else figure it out. So then I was heavily influenced by a Chinese researcher who moved to the U.S. as a young man. He's now 96. In his 90s anyway. I think he's in his mid-90s. His name is Gilbert Ling.
Yeah, we're big fans of Gilbert Ling.
Yeah, well, I don't know how many of your listeners know Gilbert Ling, but Gilbert was chosen after World War II among the all Chinese scholars, students, whatever. There were three who were chosen, and Gilbert came, and another of the three came as well. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics, and you know, so these were rather talented people. And
right.
And Gilbert quickly came to discover many features of biology, but one of them was that inside everyone's cells, the water molecules are not like water in a glass. They're actually lined up in ordered in some way, ordered next to the solids that are inside the cell. And he was not very popular. He was generally dismissed as a crackpot or what have you. However, I got to meet him at a symposium some years ago, and I was really impressed by not only his presentation, but by a group of people who had evidence to support his point of view. They didn't agree on every detail, but it generally supported it. And so I got some of his books. He has, I think, 6 or 7 books by now. And I gave them to my students and my postdoctoral fellows, and unanimously they said, well, you know, his stuff is not so easy to read, but there's something really, really important in this. And if he's right, this is so important for all of biology. So that's where I got started. And The Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life book was written initially to try to, you might say, educate the public on Gilbert Ling's ideas. It started that way, and after a few chapters, I came to realize that there might be more to it than Gilbert had come to. And it turned out in that book that we came to the conclusion that the water, it's not just that the water was lined up, it's that the water could... lined up in this so-called, I'll get to that in a moment, call it a fourth phase, an ordered phase of water, a structured phase, but that this water, when the cell did its job, whatever its job is, it could be, for example, contracting or secreting or filtering, whatever, you know, the particular cell is designed to do, that water underwent a so-called phase change, a tremendous change from the ordered kind of water, this different phase of water, to ordinary water. And that was the essence, the central theme of the Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life book. And then we started to get into experiments, too, because we were really curious about this structured, ordered water. What's it all about? What are its real properties and such?
Yeah, and kind of take us through what that was like when you kind of discovered this fourth phase was happening. And were you guys, like, freaking out? And was this amazing? Or were you like, well, maybe this is just a mistake?
It was a eureka moment.
Yeah.
And of course there was a lot of caution at first. We had an experimental setup that actually somebody had done before and kind of led us onto this, and we set it up in the laboratory, and in a little chamber we put a gel into the chamber, like Jell-O, and water, and in the water we put these tiny particles, they're spheres, we call them microspheres. And when we looked in the microscope, what we saw that right next to the gel, instead of seeing those microspheres in the microscope, we saw a zone, big zone, with no microspheres. This zone excluded the microspheres. And what we thought at first, and it seems to be true because we've had many, many experiments, is that the reason that there were no microspheres or no particles in this zone is that this zone has the kind of ordered water that Gilbert Ling was talking about. And one of the characteristics of this ordered water, just like ice, which is in a sense also order, it just excludes everything. And this zone seemed to exclude what turned out to be later almost everything. So we called it the exclusion zone at the suggestion of an Australian colleague. He said, hey, you know, what are you going to call it? You got to call it something. since it excludes, why don't you call it the exclusion zone?
Yeah, you need something to put on the T-shirts when you start to sell those.
Put on the T-shirts, right. But you see, it works really well for Americans because exclusion zone, EZ, is easy to remember.
Right. And just to paint a picture of this a little bit, you're saying that you put in the water a lot of these microspheres, and they were kind of evenly distributed throughout the water, but when you put it up against that gel, all of a sudden there was a zone where all of the microspheres moved out of that area.
Precisely.
Okay.
Something grew. We can actually see this exclusion zone growing. It started at zero, and then we watched it in over 5 minutes or so, this exclusion zone grew to 100, 200 micrometers, sometimes 300 micrometers, which is like a third of a millimeter. You could, in some cases, it was big enough that you didn't even need a microscope. You could just look at it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, it turned out that in 1970, somebody had found the same thing. We didn't know about it, but basically they confirmed the same observation. The investigators were, I remember their names, Green and Otori, and they were looking at a different kind of substance, not a gel. They were looking at, well, they did use a gel as well, but the eye, the cornea of the eye. And they put it in the chamber in the same way, and they got exactly the same result.
But they didn't have a cool name like exclusion zone.
Yeah,
so, right.
It's not an original name, but, you know, I kind of regret it a little bit because of two reasons. First of all, in Europe, it's not EZ, it's EZ. So it's not EZ to remember. so it doesn't work exactly. And the second is, well, you know, so it's more than just exclusion. Exclusion is just one of, and maybe one of the least important of the properties that this has. So as we said, you know, this is like a different phase of water. And there are two characteristics of it, besides the exclusion. There are a couple of characteristics that make it so interesting. And the first characteristic is that, you know, ordinary water, H2O, is not charged. It's neutral, right?
Right.
So, but we found that this zone was negatively charged, and the region beyond, so you got this exclusion zone or fourth phase, negatively charged. And if you go beyond that, farther away from the gel or the whatever you've put there, it's positively charged. So you got minus in one region and plus in another region. So what's going on is that we found is that the water molecules, which have negative and positive components, are splitting. And the negatives start lining up right next to the gel and build this negatively charged exclusion zone. And the positive ones are in the water. They're protons, or actually protons stuck to water molecules, which makes them hydronium ions. But anyway, they're spread out throughout the water. They repel each other and they easily spread out.
Are you saying the H2O of the water kind of breaks apart and the negative components move towards that fourth phase and all the positive ones move into the rest of the area?
No, not exactly, almost, but the negative ones comprise the fourth phase.
Okay.
So you start with just a gel next to water, and some of the water molecules near the gel split up, and the negative part sticks to the gel and becomes the exclusion zone. You get more and more of those and a negatively charged H2O, parts of the H2O, and they build up to make this negatively charged exclusion zone. And all the positive parts, the protons, get kicked out into the water, and they spread out. So you got a lot of protons, low pH value. That's the first interesting feature of this zone, is that it's not neutral, it's negatively charged. In fact, it's not even H2O, it's actually a variant on that. It's H3O2.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's the one. And you know, the second feature, maybe I should wait for your question, but I'm just too excited.
Yeah, no, this is what I want to hear about right here.
Yeah, so in order to separate charge and to build a kind of structure, you need energy. So you know, after you've used your smartphone, you got to plug it in to the receptacle to get the battery needs to get recharged. And recharging is a matter of separating negative from positive. So you have a battery and your battery is charged, and you can use the charged battery's potential difference for whatever you want, for doing work, right? And it's the same thing in this experiment that I told you about, or in this feature I mentioned, the buildup of the EZ or fourth phase water and the separation of charge. You can't do it without energy. Energy, yeah, it's like plugging in the battery, but you know, hell, you can't plug in this chamber into 110 volts. It doesn't lend itself to that. So the question is, you know, where does this energy come from? And we scratched our collective heads for a few years to figure out where it's coming from, because it wasn't obvious. And then we found, through some quirk, we found it's light.
How did you figure that out?
We didn't think of it exactly. What happened is that, so in the laboratory, we had a chamber sitting on the bench, and there was a lamp nearby, and one of the many undergraduate students who we have picked up the lamp, and it's a gooseneck lamp, and then brought it over to the chamber and shined it on the chamber. And as we were looking through the microscope, we saw that, hey, the exclusion zone is growing. And then he took away the lamp, and the exclusion zone went back down to its original size. And so, you know, we figured that it didn't take great brilliance to figure out that it looked like light was building up the zone. And, you know, so maybe light is even responsible for the original buildup of the zone.
Yeah,
so
I love it when you find things by accident like that.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it's serendipity. It's part of, it's what I, you know, we started with, the informality of calling people by their given names instead of their titles. There's a very good exchange that results from that. And the young students feel a sense of freedom. You know, they feel a sense, of course they get guidance, but they understand that what's more important than productivity is observing something that looks really interesting, because that's when the big findings, they come exactly from that. This was one example of that. The student really taught us, gave us a clue that the energy source for all of this stuff is light. And so we found, you know, it's not just when we think of light, we think of the visible spectrum, you know, from red to green and so on to violet. But when we speak of light, we speak of the entire electromagnetic spectrum, which which extends beyond just the visible range. It extends on one wavelength and to the ultraviolet, the other one to the infrared. And so we did a whole bunch of experiments, and we tested each wavelength from the ultraviolet to the violets and blues, the reds, infrareds, throughout. And we found what we found is interesting, that the most, they all have some effect, but the most powerful builder of this exclusion zone and the separation of charge comes from the infrared. Now, my guess is that among your listeners, not many know really where infrared comes from. So you think about the toaster, the glowing red coils, and you think of the electric range, and you say, oh, yeah, there's heat coming from there, and that's infrared. But actually, infrared energy is all around us. So the example that I like to give is, if you darken a room or go out at night when it's dark, you know, and whip out your infrared camera instead of your usual camera. So this camera picks up infrared energy that's generated by whatever is generating it. You get a beautiful image. And so the fact that you get a beautiful image means that everything is generating infrared light.
So you see infrared light on pretty much everything.
Everything. You can't get rid of it. So you might say this is so-called free energy. And, you know, those of your listeners who have taken the chemistry course might have heard the word free energy. And it has to do with what happens in chemical reactions. And it's a little complicated. But this is literally, it's there for the taking. This energy that's there for the taking is what builds up this fourth phase of water and separates the charge. So the energy is always there. And that's why the fourth phase is always there. Fourth phase is all over. It's in every cell of your body. And it's in the water that's flowing in rivers and streams and in the ocean. And it's all over.
So what you're saying is that this is an energy source that's making this fourth phase happen. And it's everywhere. And if water's everywhere, is it possible that we could actually create energy with this?
Well, not only is it possible that, but we have just yesterday received a patent.
Congratulations!
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. The patent was allowed for collecting electrical energy from this separated charge, and it works beautifully. And of course, we're trying to develop it because, you know, the world needs energy really badly.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so we're getting this energy from water fueled by the sun.
Wow.
It's amazing.
It's really simple, and it's very exciting to have this possibility. So this is only one of many implications, applications of this kind of the experimental finding. It's like, you know, it's like most original experimental findings, it leads to all kinds of possibilities for technological applications. And you know, considering that the world is, many people call it, the world is in the stage of melting down. We have a lot of problems, and the problems are awaiting solutions. And, you know, some of the solutions many of them will come from discoveries, fundamental discoveries that are made that you never would have thought of. But here they are, and they have implications that are really broad. I think it's possible that this falls into that class.
At least, yeah. And do you have thoughts or hopes of what type of applications that you would want to create initially with this patent, and how you want to use this creation of energy?
Yeah, I mean, well, this one could be used, for example, for sensors that are remote. You know, you don't want to put a battery in there, and the battery wears down, and you have to go to these remote places to replace them. And also, you know, ordinary solar cells, they work fine when the sun is out, but they work less fine when it's nighttime. Well, this one is based on infrared energy, not on visible energy, and the infrared energy is always there, so it has the capacity to work round the clock. Now, it doesn't produce that much energy, at least right now. This is our prototype that we've been working with. It produces about a milliwatt, which is enough to light an LED or to to power a sensor. But of course, this is, you know, this is the very beginning, and the future is open.
Yeah, and if it works even in that small regard, you have to assume that, you know, after figuring some things out, that we'll be able to expand that into something incredible.
Precisely.
Well, just in case, in case everybody's just getting too excited about this and they haven't said it, we want to say thank you just for figuring that out, because that's pretty amazing.
No, that's awesome.
Thank you. I'm flattered by it. We got some other, you know, just I mentioned one more because there's another one that for which we have a patent, and it's a filter. You know, I mentioned that this exclusion zone excludes, so it excludes pretty much everything, including bacteria, heavy metals, the stuff that you don't want in your drinking water. And so we devised, based on that principle, we devised a filter, and you just collect this water. We devised a way of collecting it. And the results so far are remarkable in this device. We can put these spheres, tiny spheres in, and in one pass through the filter, the stuff that comes out has better than 1%. It takes away more than 99% of those microspheres, and we know it works with bacteria and such. So we're also trying to develop that one into something that could be useful, because first of all, filtering this junk from the water is really important, and you can do it without, for example, reverse osmosis, which is very costly in terms of energy. This is based on the energy of the sun. See, so it doesn't.
So we have some of that, yeah.
We have some, yeah. And also, the really exciting part is that it looks like, we're not sure, but it looks like this can also filter out ordinary salt. So if you take ocean water and put it in, it's possible. Again, we're not sure, but we think preliminary results are encouraging that you can get rid of the salt and have drinking water without putting in energy except from the sun.
Wow, that's really incredible.
Awesome.
So basically, you're saying with this filtering system that you're putting water in and then you're pulling out just the EZ water?
That's correct. It's the EZ water.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And the EZ water, we think, also is better than just pulling out H2O, because the EZ water is similar to the water that's inside your cells, you see. And so if you drink the EZ water, preliminary evidence, again, it's preliminary, suggests that could replace any of the missing water in your cells. In other words, most of us are dehydrated to some extent, and for our cells to work properly, it needs a full supply of water. And if your cells are deficient of water, especially for people whose hair has turned gray, we tend to be dehydrated. It's becoming more and more apparent that as you get older, you don't sense the dehydration, but you're dehydrated. You need to drink a lot of water each day, a lot of water. I'm talking, you know, like 100 ounces or something like that, to keep yourself well hydrated and over the long run. And if you drink EZ water, which will come out of that filter, you got a better chance of rehydrating with drinking less
volume.
Right.
So explain this a little bit then, because you hear a lot about that the health of a person or a cell or a plant or whatever, like the healthier people seem to be more negatively charged, like in those cells areas, and the more positively charged can cause problems. So is the EZ water more negatively charged, and is that push us in that direction or help that out?
Precisely. So it was actually coming back to Gilbert Ling. It was Gilbert Ling who invented in his early years an electrode. It's called a glass microelectrode that you could stick into a cell, and you could measure the electrical potential. And it's always negative. And this is not any controversial issue. Any physiologist knows that cells are negatively charged. So the question is, why are the cells negatively charged? Kind of an oddball thing. And they're very complicated explanations that I learned as a student. And, you know, it just suddenly it came that, you know, it's possible, and I think it's true, that the negative electrical potential comes from the fact that the water inside the cell is negatively charged. So the easy water is negative. Your cell is full of negatively charged easy water, and therefore your cells are negative. And so the more water you have in the cell, the more easy water, the more negative that your cells are going to be. In fact, we're all negative. We've measured people and their electrical potential relative to ground, and we're all negative. And you know, we have some experiments that show that the people that really healthy people are more negative and healthy. Like, for example, we had a case, walking pneumonia, not negative, very much negative at all. And all this kind of fits together and makes sense because hydration is really, really serious. In many of the diseases, we're dehydrated, even the flu. So we become dehydrated. And dehydrated means our cells have less easy water, right?
Right.
And therefore, less negativity. So it may be an extremely simple paradigm.
And are there other things in our current life and this, the way that we live this life now, and some of the horrible things that we put in our body, et cetera, are there things that you see that would make someone less negative at the cellular level?
Good question. Less negative. Well, yeah, I mean, anything that that will wear away or deplete the fourth phase water inside your cell would do it. And you know, we haven't tested too many things. One student began to experiment with glyphosate, which is in Roundup, and he found indeed that easy is depleted.
Wow, what an interesting thing to test out. That was a great idea.
You know, again, this is not published yet. We're still into it, but so far the results look that way. And we have perhaps a half dozen different substances that are good for health, that improve health in various ways, where the easy is increased. And so that includes, so far we've done aspirin. You know, aspirin is pretty good for, it's acetylsalicylic acid. It comes from the bark of a willow tree. It's natural, and people use it for anything from a headache to pain relief to inflammation inhibition to even improves their heart. There's a fair amount of evidence for that. And aspirin a day helps prevent heart attacks, and I saw about a year ago a group from Harvard University showed that women who have breast cancer, that if they take an aspirin a day versus no aspirin, that their survival rate increases by, I think it was about 50%. So aspirin is widely effective in promoting health, and you kind of wonder, well, you know, how could it be effective for so many things? So you ask yourself, well, what's common to all of those organs and such is water, you see? And so the idea is that if aspirin were to build easy water, that would kind of explain why it has such a uniformly positive effect, and that's exactly what we found.
And do you have an opinion of why things would build more easy water? Is it just that they're increasing the negative charges, or is there another pathway?
You know, I'm not sure of that. It's a good question. We don't know the answer. I'm sorry. I can't really say. But I just wanted to continue on the tack that we tried vitamin C, we tried probiotics, and I think there are one or two more. And quite uniformly, the substances that are good for health build easy water, and therefore the hypothesis is that as a generality, it's possible that many things that are good for us are good because through the water, through building easy water, which we need for proper function. And so far, only one that we've tried. We have a lot to try, some of the agents that impair it. I know that some of my colleagues studying, for example, chlorine and fluoride that are in somewhat waters, they tell me, we haven't studied it, that this stuff is poison. And so we need to try, but it's possible that they have a negative effect on easy water.
Yeah, this would be a great, you know, way to investigate things, to have another viewpoint or even a confirmation of things that we think are bad. If we see them reducing the easy water, then that could be another reason to want to avoid them.
I agree with you, and that's why we're focusing on that. You know, we're sort of limited by funding. Unfortunately, you know, institutions like the National Institutes of Health, which have funded my stuff for, you know, my whole career, and I am thankful for that. But you know, lately getting into the idea of water and health and such is so far from any kind of theme that interests them that it's really difficult to get money. So, for example, one thing that everybody asks, I get emails and phone calls all the time, which water should I drink? And the answer is, well, I don't know which water you can drink. We know a fair amount about water, but I can't give you an answer because I can give you a theoretical answer, but what you really need to do is you really need to do the tests to try, you know, water A, B, C, D, and E that you can get, buy, and you test it on animals and on people and see if there's a consistent difference among the waters. So I've seen various waters that the manufacturers claim can actually reverse irreversible pathologies. You know, we're talking cancer, irreversible kidney pathology, liver pathology, multiple sclerosis, and you know, the first thing that your response is, well, you know, it's impossible. How could water do this? And their evidence, they haven't done the standard clinical trials because a standard clinical trial costs something like $100 million,
right,
you know.
Right.
So the pharmaceutical companies might have the money to test their drug, but nobody else has money to test whatever, you know, and this is a real obstacle. But if you look at the anecdotal evidence, is highly suggestive. I've seen some of it myself, and in some cases, I'm really impressed. But it's a real obstacle to be able to test these waters, and it would be great if, because everything requires money. You know, if you do experiments on mice, my colleague in Texas came to dinner the other day, and he said, "Well, how much do you think I spend on mice in my experiments per year?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, $1,000." He said, $250,000
on mice.
Oh,
wow,
yeah.
That's even more than you would spend if you saw Mickey Mouse at Disneyland.
Slightly more, yeah. It's amazing how much it costs because you have to first purchase the mice, then you have to keep the mice, you have to pay for the people who tend to the mice, you have to do the pathology later, and all of this adds up. So, you know, $100 a throw is cheap. It's probably $200 or something like that per mouse, per experiment. And think of how many experiments you need to do on each mouse. And also even to do studies on humans, to cover all the administrative costs and the advertising and getting them together and statistical analysis and all that. So what I'm getting to is that it's not trivial to do studies like that. They're real obstacles. And you know, if any of your listeners are you know, have ample means and are interested in considering funding something like this, we're talking a few million bucks, but this would be a really invaluable investment in the future of humanity. Everybody drinks water. Everybody wants to know, which water should I drink? The answer is not clear yet.
Right, yeah. We definitely need to find some people that are interested enough in changing the world and putting the money they created towards something that could really change a lot of things.
Yeah. Can I just mention one thing that's slightly out of context, but let me just take 2 minutes because
yeah,
it's something we're deeply in. It's called the Institute for Venture Science. And this institute, which we're putting together now, eventually we hope will be a $10 billion institute, but we're just starting small. And the idea is to fund unconventional ideas that challenge obsolete conventional thinking.
Wow.
Yeah. And we need this badly because if you ask yourself how many scientific revolutions or breakthroughs, fundamental science, there are plenty of technology, no doubt, but fundamental fundamental paradigm shifts like happened all the time 100 years ago with Einstein and Max Planck and all the famous physicists and such, they don't happen. It's, if I were to ask you guys to name three that have happened in the past, say, 30 years or 40 years of the same caliber, let's say, as the uncovering of the structure of DNA or the splitting of the atom or something, we're talking 60, 70 years ago, in the past 30 or 40 years, a fundamental scientific discovery that has succeeded, not promises, succeeded in changing the world, I think you'd be hard-pressed.
Yeah, the only things we discover now is, like, you know, what's Justin Bieber doing this week? You know, we don't find the good stuff like we used to.
New iPhone apps.
You don't find it because it's really hard to find. There unfortunately isn't much of this stuff. And one of the reasons is the funding agencies, the way they're designed, inadvertently, they actually encourage conservatism instead of funding and having interest in radical new ideas. It's a long story, but the end result, you can see, I mean, compared to 100 years ago, the amount of money that's put into science is astronomically higher, but the return is astronomically lower.
Right. Can you say the name of the place again that you were...
Yeah, I'll give you the URL, too. It's the Institute for Venture Science, and it's very simple. It's IVSCI, Institute for Venture Science, IVSCI.org.
Okay, great. And we'll put that in the show notes, too, so listeners can find that.
Well, yeah, anybody interested in this, please contact me, because we're actually putting together a launch symposium soon, and we're looking for funds to help get us started. I think this is really important for humanity, because humanity faces huge problems that seem to be getting worse, and the possible route to solution is scientific breakthroughs, and we had so few, we need them, and we think that we could foster those breakthroughs. We have a plan that we know can succeed. We just need to get it going.
Right, so. Yeah, it does take work. Okay, we'll put that there, and we'll also make sure we get some contact info for you, too. So
thank you.
Richard can do that. But I know we have a couple more questions if you have a little more time. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we've already talked about some amazing things that could potentially come from these observations about EC water, as far as like power generation and water filtration and water desalination, and about health. But one of the things that we try to like teach a lot of our listeners about is to try to help them understand the sort of paradigm that mainstream medicine is operating with, and help sort of reframe people to try to get a better understanding of what's actually happening physiologically, rather than just accepting various pathologies or diagnoses that their doctors may have handed them. And just a couple episodes ago, Kenna was saying, and she said something to me about, like, what are you going to tell me next, that the heart doesn't pump blood? And I was like, no, actually, like, light does that. And we got into this conversation. She's like, oh, my God, I can't handle it. But, like, that's just one implication of what you're saying. Like, yes, the heart plays a role in blood circulation. But it really, truly, light, as you were saying, light really, truly does power these easy zones.
Well, yeah. I mean, I need to comment that. So the story, you know, about light and about the heart is a little more subtle than we think. So of course the heart pumps blood, you know, that there's no question about it, and it pumps the blood into the large vessels, into the aorta and the smaller arteries and the arterioles. But the problem arises when you get to the really small vessels like the capillaries. So it turns out that the capillaries are only roughly half of the diameter, the small capillaries, of the red blood cells that have to pass through the capillaries. This is a problem, you know, it's kind of like a plumbing problem, engineering problem. How do you stuff these big, galumphing red blood cells through the small capillaries? And it's kind of analogous to having a toilet where the drain pipe is kind of narrower than all the stuff that has to pass through the drain pipe. I think all of us have encountered problems like that. Yeah, so it turns out that you can see in videos of these small is that the red blood cells have to squinch down. They bend enormously in order to squeeze through. And the amount of resistance is very high. So the amount of energy that you need to push these red blood cells through these capillaries it turns out to be enormous. So my Russian colleagues from Moscow University calculated how much pressure or it was needed to push it through. And if the heart were responsible for pushing these red blood cells through these small capillaries, it would need to generate approximately a million times the pressure that it actually generates.
Wow.
So that's out of the question. Even if they're off by a factor of 10 or 100 in their calculations, it's still, you know, it just doesn't work. So you think, well, what else could be responsible? So it turns out that the answer, I think, is light. And the reason I think it's light, we're doing experiments on this right now, the reason I think it's light is that in the laboratory, we could see that if we take put a tube similar to a capillary, but it's bigger than the capillary, and we put it in the water, and the water has some particles in it, so we can track the water's movement by tracking the particles, that we found that the water flows naturally through the tube, like inside of a straw, flows through the straw. Now, at first, when we saw this, we thought, oh, this is impossible. I almost fell off my seat when the student came in to tell me what he'd observed. But we studied it extensively, and we found out that this is actually a result. I won't try to explain without a diagram. It's a result of the growth of this fourth phase of water, and it's the effect of light. So it's the light that's coming into and absorbed by the water in the chamber that supplies the energy, and the energy drives the flow through the tube, and it just keeps going. We've had it going for a day and a half.
Wow. And so the water, it's creating movement, even though nothing else in the water is creating the movement.
Correct. Right. It's the light that's absorbed, which sets up a pattern. I don't want to go into the pattern, but we have papers on this, and it's in my book.
And you have a great visual of this in one of your TEDx talks too. We could put a link to that on the show notes so people could see that.
Sure, yeah. Thank you. That'd be great. Yeah, it's a nice visual. And so if you project what we found in the laboratory to what happens inside of you, so you got these small capillaries, you've got blood that needs to flow through, and you got light that you're absorbing all the time from outside. Even from inside, the metabolic processes that go on generate infrared energy, and the infrared energy is the driver of this. So you get flow, a tremendous amount of energy to drive the flow through these capillaries. And so it may not be the heart that does the job. It may actually be inside these small vessels. It may be light, surprisingly, light that you absorb from the environment, from inside, that's driving the flow through your capillaries, and that is responsible ultimately for the exchange of nutrients and oxygen and such that keep you alive.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's just one of like so many incredible examples that you give in both books, really. In the fourth phase of water, also you talk about how EZ gives like joint capsules, their slipperiness, and there's just so many different ramifications for this new understanding of water that you're helping to bring to light, that it really highlights to me like how much of modern medicine is sort of like off their basis of like their pathologies, their diagnosis, but also their prognosis of like what they go about, their methods of trying to correct these different health problems. It just seems like with as fundamental as a thing as like the cell and the water, cell membranes, and the opposite sort of principle of the association induction hypothesis we haven't really talked about yet, but it just seems like that whole paradigm that's built on this cell membrane like outdated model has got to lead to a whole bunch of error in modern medicine. I was hoping you could talk on that for a minute, like what else could we see change or evolve in medicine if we were to embrace this new understanding of like the actual structure of the cell not being so much this fat sandwich theory and more the association induction theory?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with you more than 100%. One of the problems with medicine, it's like all sciences, we call it medical science, it's the same with physics and with chemistry and biology, all the sciences, is that, you know, we're taught from the textbook, we're taught various paradigms, and then we learn them, and then we teach them to the next generation, who teaches them to the next generation. And once it's been sealed in the textbooks, it's right.
We just
can't get rid of it. And you know, imagine you're a textbook publisher, and you're about to publish a textbook, say, on physiology or so, and And there's this alternative view, which looks pretty attractive, but you want to sell books. And so you realize that are the medical students going to be reading this radical views or the standard view? And, well, of course, the people are going to opt for the standard textbook. And so imagine this gets perpetuated through the generations. And we learn the same thing, only with very minor change. Of course, there are changes. Everything seems to get, if anything, more complicated, more detailed, and difficult to understand. And it's really hard to break free of that kind of paradigm. It's just because our culture doesn't allow us, doesn't put great value on true innovation and fresh thinking. Mostly it gets suppressed. I have various colleagues and friends whose views on various aspects of science and medicine, we mentioned Gilbert Ling, these people get sidelined. They're often called denialists, like Holocaust denialists, because they don't believe in a certain paradigm. So they get marginalized and they lose. They can't get their funding, and they sort of disappear from the scene. This needs to be changed at the core. We need to be a society that's more open to fresh views. And frankly, in terms of the question you asked about medicine, I think that so much of what's taught is simply wrong. And if you start with a new idea and a new paradigm that starts with the cell and what's the cell made of and how is the water, you can come up with understandings that I believe are much simpler and make much more sense. But the challenge is to get these ideas discussed and accepted. I feel actually somewhat fortunate because the stuff about water is actually making pretty good. Many people are reading the book, and I've been the reviews on Amazon have been really, really flattering.
Yeah.
I wish my mother was still alive. So sort of thing. So people are beginning to, but the water is the center of all of this. But it needs to pick up. It needs to bootstrap into some movement of some kind. I don't know how to do that, but the culture needs to change. I'm afraid that modern medicine is not leading us in a productive direction.
You know what?
So I hope my next book. Well, my next book is almost written. It deals with basic physics and an understanding of the universe. Sorry, that's sort of off track. But the one after that, I hope, will deal with the issue that you just mentioned about health, wellness, the cell, physiology, and how we can understand that in a simpler way that matches with evidence and is not basically conjured and is just a kind of reiteration of what people think they've known for 100 years.
Yeah, and a perfect example of that is how Ling disproved the cell membrane pump theory. Do you want to maybe explain how that was figured out?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so 40 years ago, 50, I don't remember how many years ago, it was suggested that the membranes contain pumps, and the reason, it turns out that the cell has a lot of potassium in it and very little sodium. And the flip side is true outside the cell. So how can you get this kind of asymmetrical distribution? And the idea came forth that there's a sodium-potassium exchange pump. And what does is it pumps the sodium from the inside to the outside of the cell and pumps the potassium from the outside to the inside. That seemed to make a lot of sense for some people. But Gilbert Ling did experiments, and what he did was to poison the cell, and he developed a cocktail of poisons that could poison anything. You know, it was a terrible cocktail, and so the cell was effectively dead. Yeah, and so basically you've pulled the plug on the pump. It's not pumping anymore, yet the effects of the pumping were still there for many, many hours. And so he said, well, this is just impossible because the cell doesn't have the energy to do all this pumping. And he calculated, giving in the most generous way to his opponents, that the cell had more than 30 times less the energy that it needed to pump the sodium and the potassium.
Right.
See, but that's just the beginning. You know, since Nobel Prizes were given for the sodium potassium pump, a lot of people began discovering other pumps, and by now, the number of pumps in the cell membrane is, well, depending on who counts, I think officially there is something like 1,000 or something, but my students who know some other students who study this tell me that unofficially there are actually 2,000 or 3,000 pumps. Virtually everything has to be pumped.
There's not a lot of room left for a membrane.
There's no room left for it's filled up. But not only the fill that it's filled up, and you know, new ones keep appearing, there's just no space for it. So, but also the energy requirement, if you need 30 times the amount of energy that's available to power the sodium potassium pump, well, you know, where do you get the energy to pump all the to power all the other pumps? And you know, these are questions that are so simple but people don't face them because it's fashionable to discover yet another pump in the cell membrane. You know, you can plant your flag of discovery.
Right.
So it's very nice, and it's the same with ion selective channels. Membrane is now said to have a bunch of channels, and substance flows through pretty much through its own selected channel. And the number of channels, I can't remember the number, but I think it's a few hundred now that have come into being. Again, Nobel Prizes were given. And there's, as you mentioned, there's the space issue. But there's also an issue of, you know, an issue of logic, because all of these channels need to have different sizes because the substances that flow through them are different size. So if you look at, say, the channel for the biggest substance that has its own channel, this galumphing molecule that goes through its own private channel, when the channel opens to let this big substance through, the question is, why don't all the smaller ones flow through the same channel? Why do they need their own channel?
Right.
It's like, you know, it's like a dike, and you have different holes for different things, and you have one big one. When this big one opens, everything flows through the big one. It doesn't choose the smaller ones. It's indiscriminate. So
right.
It's very hard. It's a real challenge to figure out how this giant channel can exclude everything else except this large substance. It challenges the imagination. And then the one that's slightly smaller has to allow one thing to flow through, and all the ones smaller than it have to be excluded too. It's an intellectual challenge to figure out how this could happen. So it's a logical conundrum that people have not faced. And so we then come up with a cell membrane that has all this gadgetry that's extremely complicated and getting more and more complicated. And the question is, well, you know, do we really need this? Is there a simpler kind of interpretation? I think there is, but you know, this is beyond what we're talking about right now. But we've gone astray.
Well, that's how we do it. So looking over our notes, we only have 737 more topics that we want to ask you about, but we are running out of time. So why don't we see if we have one more that Will wants to cover, if you have time to do that.
Yeah, I mean, there are really so many more things I wanted to ask, and I guess just on that last point, just to share with our listeners, in your book, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, you also lay out all the other problems that are present with the membrane pump, like the fact that you can cut cells in half and the pumps still work magically somehow and they don't leak their contents.
Yep.
And just there's just a lot of really blaring logical incoherencies that come about if you try to justify the actual membrane pump theory. But I had one other like geeky sciencey question to ask that hopefully we have time for is, could you, I know like through polarities is maybe essentially the biggest bird view sort of answer to this question, but in some way, can you explain how ATP actually kind of works to help create movement and function in the cell and how it affects water?
Well, yeah, I have a few comments on ATP. So, again, this is another problem. If you ask any biologist, will tell you that ATP holds it's the coin of the realm. It holds the energy for everything that cells do. And so I think it was probably 100 years ago or 80 years ago that it would, that this was discovered, that ATP has a special high energy bond. And that bond contained all this potential energy that was used to drive all kinds of processes, essentially everything that the cell does. And soon after that, some chemists came up and said, you know, there's a problem here. You made a mistake in this calculation. And Gilbert Ling, in his books, brings this up. And nobody's ever responded to those challenges, or at least nobody that he or I have ever seen. So this actually may be a kind of a misnomer or an error. I know it's an error of the most fundamental significance, if it really is an error. But the evidence seemed to be pretty strong that it was an error, and just ignored, as a lot of things are. Mm-hmm. So Gilbert Ling and his idea is that ATP, the way it works, is the molecule, it's a highly negatively charged molecule because it's got three phosphates, adenosine triphosphate. It sticks on, he calls it a cardinal adsorbent, and it helps to build this kind of structured water, what we would call EZ water. And I think his argument is probably correct. It's something like this, that these very strongly negatively charged sites allow the EZ water, he would say the structured water, to build up. And you need this water for every function. So you have to start, no matter what the cell does. I like to think about muscle cells, because we started muscles for 30 years. When the muscle is in the in the relaxed state, ready to contract, it's got a lot of ATP, it's got a lot of EZ water, and all of this, the cell is charged up, ready to go. It's got all kinds of energy just raring to go. And then a trigger comes, and the contraction occurs when the water becomes transitions into ordinary water, and possibly this high energy phosphate, something happens with that, and it becomes a different form of ATP, and the proteins all undergo a big conformational change. The whole cell undergoes a wrenching change of its structure, and then you get contraction. So ATP, it might be that the real energy, the real potential energy, is coming from the EZ water. This water, because it's ordered, it has configurational potential energy. When you get something ordered that goes to something disordered, it releases energy. And this may be the more fundamental than ATP, the more fundamental basis of the cell's energy throughout all cells. It's the ordered water and the charge that it has, that's the potential energy that drives all of these processes. Then it has to get restored again. Contraction occurs, the muscle has to relax back to its initial state, and that initial state involves not only the ATP that needs to come and bind to the particular sites, but also the ordering and structuring of water. So bottom line is, it's not so clear that ATP is really the coin of the realm or the basis for energy. I think it might be the easy water, and that one needs to look back at the original original evidence and the challenges to make their own decision as to whether the original idea is correct or not correct.
Right, and showing that the easy water, you know, creates that movement just with the light, I think that, you know, it kind of makes you have to say, okay, this, we need to look into this and see what, you know, what else is going on.
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many things to look at, and you know, you look at it through a different lens if you kind of understand that the water is right at the center of all this. And well, I mean, I apologize that we haven't gotten through your 600.
we'll have to have you back on the show to finish the other 699.
We can certainly do that. And a lot of the stuff, you know, is in those two books. That we haven't talked about. I think, and anybody who's interested, is the books will have a lot. But yeah, sure, we can do another one. And we can continue on from there.
I absolutely would love that too. And our listeners know that your books are ones that we promote. And we'll put the links to Amazon in our show notes so that people can get a hold of them too. And we went a little over time, and we really appreciate your extra time today and hanging out with us and making our brain filled with stuff that was not there previously.
Well, Your brain has a lot of easy water in it. Drink more water and you may get smarter. Smarter.
I was telling them, even with my little brain capacity, I understand like the magnitude of all the things you were talking about with the water and the light and how amazing that could be. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
so I feel like we need to buy you a puppy or something to show our gratitude just for sharing your time here. So you let us know if there's a specific type of puppy that you want or something like that.
Or work to fund his labs.
Yeah, that might be better. Fund his labs.
Yeah.
And also, for your friend...
My daughter will be thrilled. And,
for your friend in Texas with the mice... Tell him to go to Australia. They have a mice plague there every so many years, and he'd probably be cheaper for him to charter a plane, pick up a couple hundred thousand mice, and bring them back, and it would help them.
See, so we're giving answers over here,
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
We're creating solutions.
I'm here all day.
Okay, I'm with you on that. I will tell him that.
Okay, well, tell me this, Dr. Pollack. Where can people contact you and find more about you? Where should they look?
It just look under my name, the University of Washington, and it'll get to our lab website. The URL is pretty long, so I won't give it. But, I mean, if you want to create a link to it,
you can email it to me, and we'll put that in the show notes so that people can find you easily.
Okay, sure. We'll do that.
Well, thank you so much for being on.
Yes, thank you so much.
It was amazing.
My pleasure. Okay, take care, guys.
All right, thanks
you
a lot,
too.
Guys.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And you can read any of Tony's books, his Kick It In The Nut series or Done With Being series, and you can go to Will Schmidt's MyBodyOfKnowledge.net, too, to find out any fancy information. And he's got exercises on there and blogs and stuff. So,
okay, well, then we'll bye.
Bye.
Bye.